I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last night was the one and only vice presidential debate this election season when Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris separated by plexiglass dividers took questions from moderator Susan Page of USA Today. Coming up, analysis and reaction to what transpired last night. But first, the final weeks of this presidential race are taking place when the White House has become a top COVID-19 hotspot, with the president diagnosed with coronavirus, along with a growing number of administration and campaign officials and aides. Also, there's news this morning: the next presidential debate, which is a week from today, will be virtual, with the candidates in separate locations. Trump responded this morning that it was not acceptable to him, while the Biden campaign said they would participate in a remote debate. Joining us is Tamara Keith. She is White House correspondent for NPR. Tamara, a lot of news already this morning. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you again.
So what is the president's reasoning for not participating in a remote debate next week?
Well, he says it's a waste of his time. And then he says the quiet part out loud, which is he said they can cut you off whenever they want if you're dialing in by computer. His campaign is saying that his campaign manager in a statement, and his campaign manager also has coronavirus, is saying that by the time of the debate, they expect that President Trump will have several negative tests posted. It's not clear how they plan to do that or what the exact rollout is. But, you know, I would say that, as with everything with President Trump, this may not be the final word.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. He is known for changing his mind. And as we get closer to next Thursday, it'll be interesting to see what the final decision will be.
Yeah, indeed. And one White House economic advisor on another TV network said that he thought that maybe this would just be the beginning of renegotiations. Who knows? This is pretty standard for President Trump to change his mind on these things. And, the campaign says they'll just hold a rally instead. But the reality is that there is no bigger audience that the president can get to try to shake up this race or change the trajectory, which he definitely needs to change. There is no bigger audience than a national debate. He kind of needs a debate, but the calculation, at least that they're making at the moment, is that this format wouldn't be good for him.
Well, it's interesting he says that, and he does give him, he meaning, of course, the president, gives himself high marks for last week's debate. But when you look at some of the polling, some of the reaction, a lot of, not all clearly, but a lot of people in the public were very displeased with how the president behaved.
Yeah, I mean, the debate was sort of the embodiment of his Twitter persona. It was like an hour and a half of tweets. And even when you talk to people who support the president, they will often say, well, I just wish he would tweet less, or I wish he would talk less. And in that debate, he talked more. Now, that is what his campaign wanted. They came out and they said, look at that. He dominated. He showed strength. And certainly some Trump supporters I've spoken to say, yeah, that strength stands out, even if he was a jerk on stage. And they did say that he was a jerk on stage.
Wow.
So, these are regular civilian voters.
Of course.
But he's their jerk. Is kind of the way it's always gone with the president and his campaign. Is, you know, he's fighting for them, and so his interruptions, Trump supporters will say, well, look, he did that, all that interrupting. He showed dominance. That's what I want in the room with Kim Jong-un.
Let me ask you about something else.
Yeah.
And this is something that the president said on Fox News this morning, calling Senator Kamala Harris a monster, a communist. We certainly know that he does criticize anyone who criticizes him, and is particularly pointed when it comes to women. But how do you think this is going to play? And it seems, at least looking at the vote as we understand it so far, is that women play a really important role when it comes to presidential elections.
Yep, women are absolutely critical. They are the group to watch this time. White women went for President Trump last time. The question is, what will happen this time? And it seems pretty clear that he is losing white women. They are moving away from him, especially college-educated white women have completely fled from Trump. The reality of this race is that 2020 has been incredibly stable. And part of the reason for that is, I mean, the year has been incredibly unstable.
But maybe in your mind, go ahead.
Year has been totally unstable. But if you look at polling, it's been incredibly stable. Biden has been in a lead the entire time. There have been no switchbacks. Trump has been in this sort of same level of support in the low 40s. Biden has been bouncing around 50. Not much has changed. We've had impeachment. We've had a pandemic. We've had racial justice protests. We've had all of these things happen. And yet the polling basically stays the same. And what that says is that there aren't a lot of people left in America who don't have an opinion about Donald Trump. And for the people who love him, he is awesome. For the people who don't like him, they have a strong dislike and are highly motivated to get him out of office. And so President Trump attacking Kamala Harris, that as a monster, which... it's a new term for him to be using. He doesn't commonly use that term, but it fits with what he thinks his base wants. And it is the very kind of thing that has turned off voters, particularly women.
Well, and his base seems to be pretty solid around 40%, but you're not going to win the White House or re-win the White House with just 40% of the vote.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who are not part of his base who voted for him last time and have strayed. He has governed as someone who is all about the base the whole time, and he is campaigning on an idea of mobilizing his supporters. And he is a lifestyle brand. If you look at the boat parades and the flags, the huge Trump flags, Trump supporters are very energetically supportive of President Trump and will forgive almost anything. But there aren't enough of them. And he has never truly made an effort to expand his base. He's been all about the people who brought him, the people who helped him get into office, and giving them what they want.
Tamara, let me ask you about your White House correspondent for NPR. So I'm curious about what is the mood at the White House now? And I think almost by almost any calculation, it is a COVID-19 hotspot. I'm not sure how many people have tested positive who have some affiliation with either the White House or the administration or the campaign. But what is it like for people who work there, and how many people are actually going to work?
Well, I was last there on Monday and only saw in person one White House staffer.
Wow.
They are cutting people way back. They have people rotating through. You know, in some ways, the White House, it took a super spreader situation for the White House to do what most American workplaces have been doing since March, which is to stagger shifts, to not have people seated right next to each other, to have people wear masks. All of that is what they're doing now. People are starting to wear masks. They're not uniformly. And they are keeping a lot of people home, in part because so many people have tested positive that most everybody else has been exposed to them.
Well, and it kind of reminds me of, teenagers and young adults who go to bars and don't wear masks and kind of feel, for whatever reason, that they are immune from this virus. And here these are grownups, these are adults running the country.
Well, but here's the thing. They relied very heavily and obviously too heavily on testing. And I can't tell you how many times I'd have a White House official say, "Oh, I don't need to wear a mask, or you don't need to worry about me. I've tested negative today." And what we know is that those tests are fallible, and they're also only just capturing a moment in time. And obviously those tests were fallible because everyone who comes anywhere near the president is tested. And yet the president got coronavirus and so many people around him have as well.
Well, and I understand there's something like 100 people who are the White House staff. These are people that, you know, take care of the first family. Many of them have had jobs through several administrations. A White House butler has tested positive for COVID-19. Do we know how at risk the staff is at the White House?
So the First Lady's office put out a memo saying that they've required staff to wear masks since April in the East Wing, in the residence. Of course, that doesn't speak to the president and the First Lady, who are, it turns out, the ones who got sick and were contagious. The White House has been not transparent at all, let's say, about how many people have tested positive for coronavirus. Essentially, they don't release any information. It leaks out, and then sometimes they confirm it if the person is high profile enough. But if this many high profile people have gotten it, what does it say about the people whose names we don't know? Other news outlets are reporting something like 30 people have tested positive recently. We have not independently confirmed those numbers. And frankly, I think the White House has a responsibility to tell the American public what is going on in the
Sure.
people's house. But they I ask every day and get the same non-answer.
And the non-answer is what? We're not going to answer you, or the sort of more
evasive? The answer is to protect the privacy of people who are sick. We're not going to tell you how many people have coronavirus. But a number isn't really a privacy issue. Mm-hmm. It just kind of reads like an excuse.
You've been covering the White House since 2014, including the end of the Obama administration, and now, you know, just about 4 years into the Trump administration. It was famously, you know, no drama Obama. And now it's kind of one drama after another. What is it like for you, Tamara Keith, to keep up with all the news that comes out of this White House?
It's exhausting. And, you know, pollsters will tell you that the American people are exhausted by it as well, which might be one of the challenges that the president is having in his reelection. In terms of personally, the NPR White House team, we work in shifts, but just because news happens in the middle of the night or very early in the morning. So we've sort of broken our day up into shifts. But the reality is we're kind of always on. You know, you would think that the morning after a vice presidential debate might be a little bit sleepy, but the Mike Pence news cycle didn't make it past 8:05 a.m.
Well, I hope you stay safe, you and all the other reporters, NPR and others who are covering the White House.
We're taking precautions.
Tamara Keith, thank you for getting our conversation started. Thanks for joining
us. You're welcome.
You're very welcome. And she is White House correspondent for NPR. We're going to take a very short break and talk about what happened at last night's presidential debate, including disagreements over coronavirus, the economy, healthcare, protests and race, China and the U.S. Supreme Court. And there was that fly on Pence's head. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Artie Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Last night, Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris met for their one and only debate with less than a month before the election. It was more civil and more a typical kind of debate for the second most powerful job in the country than the first presidential debate last week. Separated by two plexiglass dividers with 12 feet feet between them because of coronavirus. They took questions on a range of topics from moderator USA Today's Susan Page. We're going to play highlights from last night's debate and also get reactions from our guests. And they are Camille Bird. She is Associate Professor of Political Science at Villanova University. She's completing a new book, Fired Up, Ready to Go, Pride, Shame, and Anger in Black Politics. Camille Birch, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Tom LoBianco. He's a Washington correspondent for Business Insider, wrote a book titled Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. And Tom LoBianco, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey, Marty, thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we do want to hear from you, especially if you watched last night's debate. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. There's a lot of incoming, either from last night or even early this morning. But Camille, let me begin with you and just acknowledge the historical moment of last night. Whether you support Kamala Harris or not, what we witnessed was the first woman of color for a major party debate the vice president of the United States. And I just want to spend a moment acknowledging this historic moment, frankly. And if you could just speak to that, what that means to you personally.
Oh, what that means to me personally. I mean, a great deal of pride. You know, in my work, I study pride, shame, and anger, these collective experiences. And so to see a woman on stage that looks like me, that attended a historically black college, like I attended a historically black college, to be able to get on that stage and speak so eloquently about a wide range of topics, and especially race relations, I felt extremely proud last night and incredibly enthusiastic.
Tom, let me put a question to you sort of related to the two people on the stage there. On the one hand, we had a former talk show host, that was Mike Pence, and a former prosecutor, that was Kamala Harris. Looking at these two players, what was your takeaway?
Yeah, it was really remarkable. I was kind of watching how both of them were smiling, these broad smiles as they would flip the knives in. With each debate attack, it looked very, I guess what you would call professionally nice. Every time I saw a gigantic smile or wide grin flash across either of their faces, I was like, well, here comes the hit. So very DC. And I guess the thing to wonder here too is, looking forward, both of them could potentially run in 2024 with, Harris, if Biden decides that he doesn't want to do the one-term limit. And then Pence looks like he's more than likely to be running in 2024. I was kind of wondering how much of that might presage a return to quote-unquote normal if Trump does leave, if Trump loses and then more or less vanishes from the national stage. I don't know that he ever will. But if that
time
happens.
Will tell. Yeah. Well, Tom, let me just do a quick follow-up. Do you think vice presidential debates, do they make a difference when it comes to the voters? And is 2020 an exception because of just this world that we're living in?
I mean, the thing with Trump is that, he basically created the only circumstance in which he would be supremely interested in a vice presidential debate, right? I mean, he caught the virus. None of us are really sure entirely how sick he actually is or was. There's a lot of confusion around that. But, I mean, look, the first question last night, the first question in the 2016 debate is, what would happen if you're ready to step in? Are you ready to step in for the most important job in the world? And I mean, he created the circumstances around that and elevated these guys effectively. Although now it seems like we're moving past that. The president's coronavirus diagnosis was just one more story arc this year.
Well, indeed, and we'll get to some more parts of the debate. But I do have a question for you, Camille, and I put this to Tamara Keith, and this came out early this morning. The president was on Fox News, and these are just a couple of things that he said about Kamala Harris, that she was terrible, totally unlikable. He thought she was a monster, maybe even a communist. Now, we know that the president will criticize anyone who criticizes him. We know how he has criticized women who criticize him. But this is a sitting senator, a woman of color. I'd just like to get your response to that. And what do you make of what the president was saying?
You know, we expect to see these comments, especially from what we know in the literature, when we see women candidates, the attacks that they face by their male counterparts are usually in many ways gendered, thinking about sexist commentary as well. And so calling her, you know, nasty or a monster or a threat. These kinds of attacks should not be surprising. I find that it's very troubling that we would take, you know, the gendered route with the commentary, because when you're looking at the polling data, some of the more recent polling data that came out this week from the Washington Post ABC News poll, there's a 31-point gap between the Trump administration and supporters of Biden, right? 31 points among likely female voters.
Wow.
That women are not across the board in these subgroups, looking at race, ethnicity, and age, not really supportive of the Trump administration. And so to continue, you know, with these gendered attacks is not going to bode well when you already have such a wide gender gap. And we saw that last night during the debate as well. So talking over the female opponent, talking over Senator Harris, talking over the moderator, things that you shouldn't do, who was also a woman, things that you shouldn't do when you already have this 31-point gap that you really do need to close to win the election.
Camille, let me, I don't have the clip at my fingertips, but several times Senator Harris said to Vice President Pence, "I'm talking now. I'm speaking now." How do you think people, you know, and we're getting in kind of granular here, but how do you think viewers view that?
I think for supporters of the Democratic Party, probably went over a bit well. I can see T-shirts and memes. I'm speaking right in the aftermath of this that their campaigns might push. But on the other side of that, you know, again, the gendered, more racial critiques about that coming off as angry or about that coming off as aggressive. And so constantly having to be aware, women broadly construed, but particularly women of color, you know, when you are speaking publicly, when you are speaking in different settings, whether they be meetings, how you have to strike the right tone so as you don't come off too threatening or you don't come off too emotional. And so in my own mind, I think she did a great job, you know, standing up for herself and saying, "I'm speaking, please don't interrupt me, please allow me to finish, please give me equal time." I see in the future, I think there'll be a nice bump in the polls for her. And I think it's what Democratic supporters wanted to see her do last night in the debate.
Well, let me get a man's perspective on this, Tom. How did you see that?
Yeah, you know, look, what she did with Senator Harris did with Pence is, I'll be honest, like, frankly, it's a pretty good tactic, whether you're debating him or whether you're interviewing him, because, you know, he likes to filibuster. I was really surprised to see how insistent he was on it, just steamrolling Susan Page, the moderator from USA Today, a longtime veteran journalist from Washington. And, you know, as I was watching that, I kind of thought to myself, you know, I understood Page's apprehension in cutting him off. You know, she was being very, very polite. And afterwards, you know, you saw George Stephanopoulos make the point that it really looked like Pence was mansplaining his way over two women on stage last night. It just didn't. Now, you know, I'm not sure how bad that looks for him among conservatives. It probably does not play very well amongst the center of the country and certainly not amongst Democrats and the left. But I have to say that, you know, saying "I'm speaking here" is pretty, I mean, that was a clean cut. That was a good way of handling it, frankly. You know, you have to think that they learned quite a bit from watching how Tim Kaine kind of got flustered in 2016 debating against Pence.
Well, Camille, I know you want to say something because I heard you say something while Tom was talking there. But I mean, I think, and I'm here speaking for most women here, I think whether you're a woman of color or a white woman like myself, We've all been in situations where what we have said has been either undercut or interrupted by, frankly, a white man.
Right. Being undercut or interrupted, being talked down to in the form of mansplaining as he was speaking, I was saying amen, right? Women are familiar with that experience. And I think for a number of women, you know, watching last night, that experience was all too familiar. I know what it feels like to be cut off when I'm talking. I know what it feels like for my comments, you know, to be undermined by someone. I know what it feels like when I'm bringing facts to the table and someone is telling me that those facts are wrong and we're supposed to believe that other person because they're a man. So I think that probably didn't play too well, again, among women across the spectrum, especially when you have that 31-point gap, right? You can't afford to lose suburban white women especially. And I think that after seeing that, you know, those experiences are ones, like you said, Marty, that women across the board share. And watching that debate as a woman, I was reminded of times when that happened to me and how I sure did not like it.
Very quickly, let me reintroduce you. Then I do want to play a clip from the debate, and we've got lots of people that want to join us as well. That's Camille Burge. She's an associate professor of political science at Villanova University. Tom Lobianco is with us as well, D.C. correspondent for Business Insider, talking about last night's vice presidential debate. Let me play a clip. It's about a minute. This is Vice President Mike Pence. He's answering a question about the Rose Garden event as a super spreader event and why people should trust this administration when they aren't following CDC guidelines.
The difference here is President Trump and I trust the American people to make choices in the best interest of their health. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris consistently talk about mandates, and not just mandates with the coronavirus, but a government takeover of health care.
Thank you. Thank you.
The Green New Deal, all government control. We're about freedom and respecting the freedom of the American people.
Let's talk about respecting the American people. You respect the American people when you tell them the truth. You respect the American people when you have the courage to be a leader
done,
speaking of those things that you may not want people to hear, but they need to hear so they can protect themselves. But this administration stood on information that if you had as a parent, if you had as a worker, knowing you didn't have enough money saved up, and now you're standing in a food line because of the ineptitude of an administration that was unwilling to speak the truth to the American people.
Tom, let me give you a chance to respond to that. What did you make of that moment?
Yeah, you know, the thing with Pence, and actually, if I could real quick go back to what you and Camille were talking about just earlier. You know, one of the things that I saw with Pence, at least, and kind of still see now, is he comes across as very anachronistic. And, you know, look for, you know, those of us, you know, in the I-95 corridor out on the coast, quote unquote, coastal elites, you know, that it looks outdated. But I will say that there is a large portion of the country, certainly in the center of the country, where that does play well.
Sure.
You know, now to his answer here with the coronavirus, I mean, I'm not sure you can avoid the coronavirus. You just can't. The thing is, unfortunately, it's omnipresent right now. It has not dwindled. It looks like we're in the middle of a resurgence. I think, you know, certainly from talking with Republicans close to the president, close to the campaign, there was a feeling that he might be able to use his diagnosis to drum up a sympathy vote, maybe use it as like a, you know, couple days storyline. You know, going into the debate, we saw that the Pence and his team wanted to use an attack on terrorism and the handling of ISIS during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. That really didn't go anywhere. You know, frankly, that went about as far as Trump's attack on Hunter Biden a week earlier, which really fell flat. You know, one thing I heard from Republicans afterwards who were kind of sympathetic to Pence but don't really like Trump is that Pence was dealt a bad hand and did the best thing. He did the best job he could defending a bad operation.
Let me read a couple of comments, one from Beverly, and then if we can scroll up, I want to get Dave's comment. But Beverly says, the hottest topic during last night's debate in all the texts from my daughters-in-law and friends was expressing their anger about Mike Pence repeatedly talking over two women, male chauvinists on display. Can we scroll up, Dave, the email from Dave? And he says, if we can get it up, I'm here. I'm helpless here. Oh, there we go. I have to disagree with your guest. A speaker cannot defer to woman to a woman simply because she is a woman. What I saw were two equal debaters, Ms. Harris and Mr. Pence, interrupting each other equally. Camille, can you respond to that? I mean, this gets tricky, and I think oftentimes people will see what they want to see in a debate, something like this, but we all get to watch it, and we all get our own opinions. But what are your thoughts?
And I mean, I think that tension is expressed in the comments of your guests, right? The first one who said that she and her daughters and her friends couldn't stop texting about what seemed to be those interruptions, right? So again, when you look at even the time of them speaking, I think they were within a minute of each other. So in the grand scheme of things, to what extent did it actually make a difference in terms of actual speaking time that they received? Not much. But going off of the comments of your two guests, the first being the woman that made the comment about male chauvinism, very clearly there was something going on there that a wide range of Americans and especially women were feeling during that debate. And so we can disagree with that, you know, all day long. When we look at the talking time, they're almost, you know, fairly equal.
I noticed
but the
that.
Way in which these things were interpreted, you know, by the different, you know, binary gender folks is interesting to me, right? And again, it's definitely reflected in the commentary of your guests. One saying, I just saw a debate, two people well-equipped. The other one saying, well, my daughters and I and her friends, we noticed this difference, right? So we can see that tension happening right there in terms of interpretation.
Indeed. And Tom, we're almost up on a break here, but do you think Pence did a better version of Trump than Trump did and that Harris did a better version of Biden than Biden did the week before?
I mean, well, you know, to what Camille said and to your listeners, I saw the same thing last night with my friends. I mean, a highly informal polling. The guys tended to be saying that Pence looked like he was doing well. And the women were like, what the hell is this guy doing? so you have pretty highly informal survey, but you know, pretty consistent with, you know, what everyone's saying here. You know, the question for Pence really is, yeah, he did clean up for Trump, you know, as best he could. One thing that kind of stuck out to me, you know, understanding a little bit of his previous debates.
You know what, Tom, yeah, if you don't mind, only because we're up in a break and I don't want to have to jump in right at the high point of what you're going to be saying there. That's Tom LoBianco. Also with us, Camille Burge, and we are talking about last night's vice presidential debate. Much more to talk about, some more clips as well. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about last night's vice presidential debate with Tom LoBianco. He's a Washington correspondent for Business Insider, wrote a book about Mike Pence titled Piety and Power. Also with us, Camille Burge, and she's Associate Professor of Political Science at Villanova University. She's completing a book to be called Fired Up and Ready to Go, Fired Up, Ready to Go, Pride, Shame, and Anger in Black Politics. Tom, I had to jump on you there, but go ahead and finish your thought, and then we'll play another clip.
One of the tells I saw from Pence last night that seemed to, I mean, he seemed to be just a little bit off his game. He's, I mean, he came off as incredibly clean and, you know, very disciplined and very aggressive last night. And but, you know, he did something kind of interesting. He used the same kind of crutch to deflect Kamala Harris twice last night, where he talked about, you know, you're entitled to your opinions, but not your own facts. And I don't, you know, he's not a guy that resorts an awful lot to kind of like throwaway lines like that. It just felt to me watching him like he was a little bit tired and a little bit overwrought.
Well, that's interesting. And I mean, he tested negative for coronavirus, but he does work at a White House that is a COVID-19 hotspot.
Yeah, I mean, look, absolutely. I did not. I saw the questions about what was happening with his eye. We saw the fly. I think the fly is a little more definitive than the eye when it comes to Mike Pence.
I knew we were going to get to the fly at some point. I'll just let it sit there like they did last night, I guess.
Highlight of the night.
Okay, there you go. Let's get serious now. Let me play one more, another clip. And this is, again, about a minute. And this is this whole question about transparency around President Trump and Joe Biden's health. Senator Harris brought up the reporting that the president had only paid $750 in taxes. And that's from a series of New York Times exposés.
We now know Donald Trump owes and is in debt for $400 million. And just so everyone is clear, when we say in debt, it means you owe money to somebody. And it'd be really good to know who the president of the United States, the commander in chief, owes money to, because the American people have a right to know what is influencing the president's decisions. And is he making those decisions on the best interest of the American people, of you, or self-interest?
Thank you, Senator Harris. I want to give you a chance to respond, Vice President.
Well, look, I respect the fact that Joe Biden spent 47 years in public life. I respect your public service as well.
Thank you.
The American people have a president who's a businessman, he's a job creator, who's paid tens of millions of dollars in taxes, payroll taxes, property taxes. He's created tens of thousands of American jobs. And the president said those public reports are not accurate.
Interestingly, Camille, let me give you a chance just to respond to that. And this came out, you know, frankly, just before the presidential debate last week about the taxes. And these are federal taxes. Yes, he's paid payroll and property taxes. But according to the New York Times, has not paid a lot when it comes to federal income taxes. Camille?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've already seen the Biden-Harris campaign capitalizing on this report in the form of campaign advertisements and having people make statements about how much they paid in taxes and, you know, reflecting, allowing people to reflect on, I'm a school teacher, I'm a construction worker, or I have a number of other jobs. This is how much I paid in taxes. And then their general reactions to the report about taxes. And so not something that's incredibly favorable, right? Again, I'm not sure that it's something that moves Republican voters that are already part of his coalition over to the Democratic side. I think this is more meat for the people that might be in the middle and or on the fence as another evidentiary check about why they will not support Donald Trump and are trying to move quite possibly towards Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
Let me change topics here. Tom, let me put this to you because you did a book about Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. This is a question from Joyce. Pence was asked about Roe v. Wade. He didn't comment on that. He said he was pro-life. Why would he say he's pro-life but not comment on Roe v. Wade? Help us understand sort of how he talks about abortion and Roe. And you tweeted about this somewhat last night.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, look, the general public, for, you know, at least the political junkies that pay attention to this stuff now see what, it, you know, those of us have been covering him for a little bit see routinely, which is that he doesn't give you detail. He doesn't give you a lot to hang on to and try to figure out. And I think I said last night on Twitter that it's like trying to get details out of him is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It just doesn't happen. I remember back in 2012 when he was running for governor, it would have been August of 2012, they had a campaign announcement. It was a job training thing out at Marion University in Indianapolis. And towards the end of the event, you know, regular press event, one of the TV reporters asked him what he would do, whether he would limit the window for having an abortion in Indiana, which is, fittingly enough, exactly what he tried to do a couple years later once he was governor. He gave a very similar answer. He said he wouldn't give you specifics, but, you know, he's very pro-life and he, you know, would support anti-abortion measures. What the campaign did after that and what I have seen from him regularly since then is they stopped telling us when he was having campaign events. Huh. And the only reason we found out was because we would be on Facebook and then there's a Facebook post that looks like a news story that's a write-up of the campaign event that happened the other day that they wouldn't tell us about. So I went to his press secretary at the time, Christy Denault, and I was like, Christy, what are you guys doing? Like, we're still covering you guys. You're still running. And she's like, oh, you guys don't show up to these events anyway. And that is when Access Hollywood happened in 4 years ago, almost to the day. Pence went into hiding. He ditched his traveling press corps. He did the same thing during the Ukraine hoax, or not Ukraine, I'm sorry, Ukraine investigation, spending too much time covering the Trump White House. It's a thing for him. And your caller, your listener is absolutely right. We don't get clear answers from him.
But it's so interesting. I mean, he is, as he describes, pro-life. I mean, I think there's no question that Mike Pence opposes Roe, opposes abortion. It's just so interesting, Tom, very quickly, if you don't mind, that he wouldn't be more demonstrative about that. If that is truly what you believe, then why not say it?
I think it's just hardwired to duck, dodge, dip, and dive. You know, I mean, he can't. It should have been a softball, right? Okay. You know, there's another thread within, too, which is that he's really terrible at talking about himself and saying what he would do and giving a sense of how he would govern. He's great at carrying the water for other people, you know, for instance, like Donald Trump. It's just how he's hardwired.
Camille, you want to jump in on this?
I mean, yeah. You know, we know that Mike Pence is a hardcore pro-lifer. But we don't know the details about this, right? We know that we've heard people talk about part of the selection of Judge Barrett is because of her stance on Roe v. Wade. We know that Senator Harris has taken a very strong line on reproductive rights for women. You know, if I'm a political strategist and I'm looking at this, I just don't know that it's a great move to provide details about about your stances on, you know, pro-life and Roe v. Wade so close to an election. We saw how this went in August of 2012 when Todd Akin, the Republican nominee from the United States Senate election in Missouri, made that controversial remark about legitimate rape, you know, and the female body being able to shut down childbirth after that process. And so there were many people at the time who thought that this is part of the reason that Obama ends up getting an extra bump in 2012 going into the election, because you stirred up so much of, you know, the women's support, especially women that are, you know, pro-choice. And so I just don't know that it's a great political strategy. Again, to be talking about these issues so close to the election when there's such a huge gap, gender gap, in terms of support for the different candidates.
James left a comment saying, I was disappointed that Kamala Harris seemed to hold back and not hold the Trump administration accountable. She had a few good shots, but I felt like she played it too safe. Let me ask about the Green New Deal, which Vice President Mike Pence pushed a lot when it came to Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and the Democrats and AOC. She got a little mention there last night as well. And if you don't mind, Camille, let me just go back to you. How you see the issue of climate, the environment, the fires, the hurricanes, and all that, and even fracking, which she did say, Vice President Biden has said he does support fracking, not on public lands, but nonetheless, he's not opposed to fracking. How do you think this will play, especially among progressives in the Democratic Party?
I mean, I feel like, you know, part of the strategy for President Trump and Mike Pence in these debates, for President Trump in the first debate, was to try and sow division between Joe Biden and the more progressive wing. When he was like, you don't support the Green New Deal, when Joe Biden made that statement. But last night, I feel like Mike Pence was serving up Kamala Harris to the progressives, you know, citing the fact that Newsweek says she's the most liberal person in the Senate. And while that may be something that turns off the Republican base and the coalitions within the base, I think it's a nice appetizer for the progressive voters, you know, who are feeling apathetic and concerned, the Sanders supporters primarily, that this ticket is not going to meet their needs. And so I think characterizing Kamala Harris as overly progressive is not going to hurt her, like, among the Democratic coalitions. Like, they need the buy-in from the Sanders supporters like yesterday. And so the fact that last night, the characterization as, you know, overly progressive, I just don't know that actually hurts Harris and Biden in the long run. It may alienate some of the more moderate voters, but the people that they really need to be concerned about picking up are the people in the wings of the party, the progressive wing of the party, that are not excited or enthusiastic about a Biden-Harris ticket.
Interesting. Tom, I don't have a clip, and we have a third clip, but unfortunately we're not going to have time for it. But at the very end of the debate, Susan Page asked both of them and quoted President Trump not committing himself to the peaceful transfer of power, essentially saying to Mike Pence, well, what would you do? A question he did not answer. And at the same time, he started trashing, you know, mail-in voting. But you, again, I'm quoting you from your tweets last night, that both he and, meaning Mike Pence and his wife Karen, vote by mail. I mean, this is something that they do when they vote. We know the president has done that when he votes as well, and yet they are trashing and undermining vote by mail.
Yeah, you know, real quick, I don't know who wrote that for Newsweek, but I'm pretty sure Kamala Harris is not the most liberal senator in the United States Senate. And I think Bernie Sanders is still in there. don't know if you get further left of him. So, you know, with the peaceful transfer of power and Pence, you know, this gets to a big theme with him. And I think this also gets to this kind of question of, you know, if after Trump, do we have some measure of elasticity with the Republicans, you know, things kind of quote unquote snapping back to normal if Trump loses. And, you know, I don't think that happens. And I think what Pence is reflecting when he gives an answer like that, he kind of ducks around what, you know, most of us would consider to be a fairly easy answer. Or I hope would be an easy answer, supporting a peaceful transfer. It's the basis of democracy. it's historic, as a matter of fact. Is that he is moving with the far right base of the party. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to me just in general that, you know, as reporters, as the pundits, as watchers of all this, you know, we don't question that the Republican Party has moved too far right. But we do question that the Democrat Party is moving too far to the left, to the other side. And that's kind of interesting. I think some of that has to do with the fact that over the last 10 years, the Republican Party has really pushed very far to the right, but it's also kind of accepted at this point. And I think you see Pence, when he does something like that, when he won't answer that question, I think he's reflecting the base in that instance.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but Camille, I do want to make sure that we at least make a mention of the fact that Breonna Taylor's name was mentioned. The issue of race did come up. How important do you think that is? And we, of course, after the summer of protests and a whole host of racial issues that have been raised in the last 6 months, at least, how did you see Kamala Harris answering those questions or responding to that issue?
Yeah, so the question that was posed was whether or not justice was done in the Breonna Taylor case and the grand jury's decision. Kamala Harris said no. She explained why. Mike Pence said that he trusts our justice system, and then he immediately pivoted to rioting and looting. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, in America, we have issues surrounding racism, right? And the first step to recovery is admitting you have a problem. And we haven't done that work. Right. There are people throughout the United States who refuse to admit that there are issues pertaining to institutional racism as well as implicit and explicit bias. And we know that these issues exist, particularly, you know, for Black Americans, from slave codes to Black codes, from Jim Crow to mass incarceration. The United States has created restrictive laws at every level of government to curtail the freedom, political power, and economic and educational opportunities of Black people. And that's just, you know, focusing on African Americans. We're not even talking about Indigenous people. We're not even talking about members of the Latinx community, Asian Americans, Arab Americans. And now the fact that when people are trying to become educated about these issues, right, being accused of being anti-American for telling a more nuanced version of what's actually happened in this country. And so I think Senator Harris's comments really do echo the wider population, the multi-generational, multi-ethnic groups of people that have been protesting in more recent months. I think she did a great job answering that question. And I think individuals will turn out to support her.
Well, we will find out in about a month. Camille Burge, thank you, as always, for joining us today in Radio Times. And Tom Lobianco, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.